From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn why people housed at Wisconsin prisons are getting less access to books. Then, we'll learn how one Milwaukee neighborhood is banding together to try to protect themselves from the effects of climate change.
What we want to do is to really start educating the people on the climate crisis that we're in and how it affects us. And how it affects us even in a more detrimental way.
Plus, we'll tell you about the Moth Project, a music and visual performance coming to Wisconsin.
I felt resonance in Moths, and I thought it'd be interesting to see if I could put together an hour, 75-minute show based around these creatures.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. The Wisconsin Department of Corrections is restricting the delivery of used books to people incarcerated in state prisons. The reason they give is to prevent drug smuggling. This comes a month after a Waupun prison employee pled guilty to smuggling drugs into the prison. At least 24 prison employees have been caught smuggling contraband into state prisons since 2019. Wisconsin Books to Prisoners, a nonprofit dedicated to sending free books to prisoners, says this decision only limits access to information while doing little to slow the flow of contraband. Mario Curran is an investigative reporter with Wisconsin Watch. He joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to discuss the Department of Corrections decision.
Can you start off with the stated reasoning from Wisconsin prison officials for restricting books to prisoners?
Sure. So the Department of Corrections notified Wisconsin Books to Prisoners that they'll no longer be able to send used books into prisons because they're concerned with a stated growing number of drugs being sent in within books. Now, this is something that often looks like these synthetic chemicals, synthetic drugs such as K2 spice that you may have heard of. And the thinking is that those can be sprayed on the pages of books. And then when they get into prisons, these pages can be torn off and used to, get high or consume these substances that way. So the Department of Corrections wants to limit all sort of paper products that are coming in. And this is really part of a broader effort that Wisconsin Department of Corrections has taken in the past couple of years to really limit sort of the products coming in that are on paper through the mail and through, in this case, books. And so really the reason is, their stated reason is to prevent the flow of drugs into prisons, which has been shown to be a problem.
Is there evidence that restricting books stops the flow of drugs or other contraband that officials would like to keep out of prisons?
The evidence that this is an approach that works is a little bit underwhelming. Wisconsin isn't the only state that has used this approach to ostensibly stop the flow of drugs. Similar approaches have been taken in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many states, as a matter of fact. And in Florida, what they found is, they had embarked on a very similar effort to restrict the flow of paper products into prisons. And, what they found in the end is they estimated they only caught, a very small percent. I think 2% of all drugs coming into prisons were actually caught through these means. So while there's evidence certainly that there are drugs flowing into prisons, we can see we have overdose. We can see overdoses that happen, medical emergencies. Those types of things do take place. What we don't know for sure is how effective these types of bans are for actually stopping that. In fact, the evidence doesn't really show that it's conclusively an approach that works.
So I used the phrase earlier, restricting books, but is it fair to call this a book ban?
I don't think this amounts to a book ban objectively. What this does is prohibits used books from coming in. In fact, the Department of Corrections will point out that this isn't something that applies just to this organization, Wisconsin Books to Prisoners. This is part of a broader ban on used books coming into facilities, as part of a broader effort to stop drugs from coming in. But books, to be fair, still can be sent in. They can be sent in through third-party retailers such as Amazon if there's a receipt. And the Department of Corrections will also point out that they do have books in their libraries. But there are those who are concerned about the broader impacts of restricting restricting these books is, and see it as just another way of sort of restricting information that prisoners have access to. And so in that right, in that light, it's really sort of a restriction on prisoners' First Amendment rights, you know, the right to access information. Because when you take a step back and look at this, this is something that really does prevent them from, really limit the types of educational opportunities they have, in a sense, the, you know, being able to read, you know, certain titles. And this is really something that is a concern to First Amendment advocates who see this as really a restriction without proper evidence that it's needed.
Yeah, and we'll get to the impact of prisoners here in a bit. But I did want to mention that in your article, you mentioned that at least 24 correctional officers have been caught smuggling contraband into Wisconsin prisons since 2019. And last month, a Waupun prison employee pled guilty for smuggling drugs into the prison. You mentioned that this is part of a larger approach to stop the flow of drugs, stop the flow of contraband into Wisconsin prisons. Has there been any action taken to address employees smuggling drugs, like there has smuggling drugs via books?
Yeah, I think that the Department of Corrections has been a little bit less vocal on its efforts to enhance screening procedures to make sure that employees or correctional officers aren't smuggling drugs or contraband into prisons. And this is something that has been shown to be a problem. There was a federal investigation that was launched last year into a sort of smuggling ring that was suspected at Waupun Prison. And this is something that we see really pop up time and again. The records that we've obtained through the help of advocates really show that there have been at least 24 instances just since 2019 where correctional officers or other staff have been caught trying to bring contraband into prisons. And so, you know, while the Department of Corrections has been pretty vocal in pointing out these instances in which, you know, employees may have gotten sick from unknown substances that could be coming in through the mail, or, you know, the drugs that may have been intercepted before they get into prisons, they've been a little bit less vocal and pointed about what they're actually doing to monitor the points of entry where staff can ostensibly bring contraband into prisons, you know, as they enter the building for work that day.
Earlier, you mentioned a group called Wisconsin Books to Prisoners. Can you explain what Wisconsin Books to Prisoners is and what they do?
Sure. So Wisconsin Books to Prisoners is a small volunteer-run organization. You know, they have sent over 70,000 books, according to their numbers, which are free to prisoners who request them. And they've been in operation since 2006. And so they have, this isn't actually their first time facing restrictions. There was some questions around their practices in 2008, you know, whether or not this was something the Department of Corrections wanted to continue. But after the ACLU got involved, they agreed to, you know, adjust their policies and keep operating. It wasn't until this past August that they were notified, hey, you know, we can no longer work with you. We're just not accepting used books in the prison. So that came really as a surprise to the organization's leaders, which, you know, as far as they were concerned, they weren't aware of any problems or any books that had been intercepted with drugs in them. So this was really sort of a surprise to them, at least, you know, as they told me through interviews.
I want to turn to the impact of this ban on people incarcerated in Wisconsin prisons. You mentioned earlier that people incarcerated in Wisconsin prisons do still have access to books. Can you explain the avenues of access that prisoners do still have?
Sure. So those incarcerated in Wisconsin prisons, they, you know, they can have books, some new books, certain new books sent in from the outside. If a family member has means, they could send a new book through Amazon or an approved third party retailer. As long as the receipt is there, they can get the book. Many facilities also have libraries, and the Department of Corrections attests, says that these are well stocked and has provided pictures of well stocked libraries. What may be missed from that is that even if a facility does have a well-stocked library, you know, prisoners don't always have unfettered access to that library. They may be, you know, offered a library visit certain times per week. But then you get into situations such as a lockdown, which we've seen last at least a year at a number of prisons. And during those lockdowns, a lot of privileges are relinquished. A lot of those, a lot of privileges aren't being offered anymore, such as library visits. So, there are ostensibly a few avenues to access books. And, I think it's universally agreed that reading is good, not just for the average person, but for, those inside incarcerated. It's a way to learn. It's a way to better your circumstance and just positive way of passing the time. And so I think there's widespread agreement that this is books are a positive venue, but the access to them is sometimes limited.
I'm glad you mentioned lockdowns at Wisconsin prisons. Do these lockdowns usually include no mail delivery?
Yeah, so, this is all happening. We're talking about books, but this is all happening within this broader effort to restrict, paper products coming in, which includes mail. So a couple of years ago, what had happened was Department of Corrections, again, citing concerns about drugs coming into the prison, decided to reroute all mail. All mail going into prisons is now rerouted to Maryland, where it's scanned by a company called Text Behind. And the photocopies are then sent to prisoners and those incarcerated. So those incarcerated are no longer getting actual paper mail, and they have many have cited concerns about that they don't have, that sort of connection to the person that was back home writing that. They can't smell the perfume on the leather. They can't see the person's handwriting the same. And so there has been this effort, an expensive one at that, to scan and photocopy mail and send that in instead of paper products. And Wisconsin Department of Corrections has spent $4 million on that in just the past couple of years. And, drugs are still coming in. So it raises a serious question of whether or not this is delivering on the stated means to really stamp out the flow of drugs into prison.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about different strategies Wisconsin Department of Corrections has taken to stop the flow of drugs into prisons. And it sounds like there's a lot of either mixed evidence or lack of evidence that restricting books or rerouting mail works. Is there any evidence of a practice that does work when it comes to restricting drugs into prisons?
I think, to be fair, the effort to stop drugs coming into prisons is a very complicated one. So this is something that is not an easy effort, and I want to recognize that. But I think it's one that would call for a multifaceted approach. And so, if you're restricting mail or scrutinizing the mail that's coming in, restricting paper products, such as the books that may be sent in, it makes less sense to not take a look at or treat as seriously the actual entry points for employees that are or may or may not be bringing those into prisons. I think that Wisconsin provided a pretty interesting test case within this past couple of years, and I'll tell you why. There were a certain number of prisons, such as Waupun, that were locked down for at least a year. And while these prisons were locked down, that meant no family was allowed to visit those who were locked up. It meant, mail was not coming in. It meant the prisoners couldn't leave their cell, but for short periods of time. And so there was very limited means for drugs to enter facilities, except the employees who may have been bringing them in. And we know that they were in there because during that time, we've seen deaths through overdoses. We know that there was overdoses happening that didn't result in death. And then, of course, we have reports from the prisoners themselves that say that have told me, look, there's just drugs everywhere. I can't leave this cell without encountering it or seeing somebody smoking weed or somebody offering it to me. So, I think that there's plenty of reasons to question, whether or not the Department of Corrections is truly doing everything that it can to stop the flow of drugs, if that's really what it hopes to do.
So what do we look for next? What does the future hold?
I think we can expect to see more of the same, frankly. I think that these efforts will continue. I've not heard any rumblings of thoughts to turn away from the mail policies as they exist or reverse the ban on used books. What we may see, if we were hoping to see fewer drugs in the prisons. I think we would hope to see, I guess, more clear communication on what is being done to stop drugs coming in from people bringing it in. You know, what is being done at the actual point of entry to really, you know, not just give a glance to people coming in, but make sure that they're not bringing in contraband through their bags or lunches or, you know, even on their person. So, you know, I think, frankly, this is part of a trend that is not really going to change anytime soon. We'll probably see more of the same types of efforts.
Well, Mario Caran, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Mario Caran is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods, and you can hear more of their conversation at WUWM.com. Climate change is causing more frequent and intense heat waves here in Milwaukee, but the city doesn't experience that heat evenly. Low-income neighborhoods and communities of color often experience higher temperatures, a legacy of historic redlining. To adapt, many community-led groups are coming up with their own solutions. Through education, resource sharing, and checking on elders when temperatures rise. This summer, WUWM's Lena Tran went to Metcalf Park, a hot spot here in Milwaukee, to learn what it looks like for the neighborhood to adapt to the heat.
It's a hot June day in Metcalf Park, and every time there's a breeze, people clap and cheer. The neighborhood organization Metcalf Park Community Bridges is throwing a barbecue today. The skin-prickling heat has slowed folks down a bit, but it's joyful. There's music booming from the speakers and plenty of towels chilling in an ice cooler. Whenever someone walks up to join the party, they're told to grab one, throw it around their neck. When it gets hot in Milwaukee, Metcalf Park is one of the places that really feels the heat. The historic industrial corridor runs through here. There are shuttered factories like the old Master Lock. There's not so many trees and lots of pavement and asphalt. All of that adds up to the urban heat island effect, where heat in neighborhoods like this gets amplified.
Even if it's 70 degrees, it feels like 90, especially on the east side of Metcalf Park. We have like the industrial corridor. We have a lot of like concrete buildings and different things like that and a lack of trees. So it's always been hotter.
That's Melody McCurtis, the deputy director of Metcalf Park Community Bridges.
We've also just been doing a lot of education around like it is getting hotter, right? It will be hot. And these are some of the things that you do to stay cool. So we're trying to work on like a toolkit where we can have like education all put together.
Climate change in Wisconsin is already driving more intense heat waves and more often. According to the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, in the next half century, the state could see 20 to 30 more days where the temperature spikes over 90. In Milwaukee, Metcalf Park will likely bear the brunt of that. So I came here to learn how Metcalf Park Community Bridges is thinking about prepping their neighbors for the heat. And education is important, but it really starts with what this barbecue is all about. Joy. Connection. Antoine Carter is flipping burgers and brats on the grill. And yeah, it's hot. But being outside on a day like this makes him think of when he was a kid, growing up not too far from here. And summer stretched out before him, infinite with possibility.
It would just be consisting of me going outside and never coming back in. For any reason, any at all, because that would be the time where your mom would say, oh, you want to come back in? Here's some chores you got to do. Shout out to my mom, Cynthia. But that would be, I would say, like playing football with my friends on like either the street or in the grass. I'd say basketball leagues, like at this time. You would wonder what warning team you would be on this year and where you would play, figuring out when people are going to the pools, when people are going to the malls. It was just literally riding your bike all day and never coming back in the house until you needed to.
trying to figure out where the fun was happening.
Oh, yeah, on the prowl, on a never-ending Nicolas Cage-like quest for fun.
There was this guy everyone called Bear. He had a unique skill set. He could pry open fire hydrants. Antoine says Bear knew when he was needed.
And Bear was like this big, strong guy, and he would crack it open. And also, too, like, the 4th of July in my neighborhood used to be lit. Just litty. With, like, all these different people would get fireworks, and they would, like, go in on them together as a group. So there'd be tons of fireworks, and all the kids would come, and some kids would get paid to be like cleanup crew, and you would see all the OGs show up and reconnect. It was a good time.
Yeah.
Antoine says he's not too worried about the heat. He knows it could be worse. It's worse elsewhere for sure. Still, when it's hot out, neighbors take care of each other.
It's just little things. It may not be a giant gesture, but just people caring that you are hydrated. People being more mindful that you should get out the sun and get into some shade. Just little stuff like that. I think those little things show they care, and it's not necessarily a big grandiose, like, free water's here. It's just, you know, make sure you get you some water. Make sure you rest. You've been doing a lot now. Go sit down somewhere. That is just little stuff like that.
Showing people that you care.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The barbecue today is part of this campaign that Metcalf Park Community Bridges started this summer. It's called We Outside. It's all about reclaiming, empowering, celebrating the neighborhood. The events range all over. Health, housing, safety, mutual aid, civic engagement. It's hard to put We Outside in a nutshell because their approach is so comprehensive. They see everything as connected. Danelle Cross leads the organization. She's been strategizing this whole time, even as she's enjoying the afternoon with friends and neighbors. Don't forget, she tells them, you got to make a list of family members to get to vote. This is her job, she says, thinking big picture, seeing the connections. When it comes to climate change and heat.
What we want to do is to really start educating the people on the climate crisis that we're in and how it affects us and how it affects us even in a more detrimental way. We are not prepared. So most of these houses, they're not equipped with air conditioning. They're not insulated properly, so they're not keeping the heat out. And so trying to help our community understand what we need to do to keep ourselves safe.
What does that look like for you?
For me, first it's education. And then it's bringing the community together to start thinking about some solutions that we can do. Because what we do know is that this community is not thought about first, second, or third. And so most of the time we have to do it for ourselves. So helping the people to figure out things that they can do for themselves right now. Staying hydrated. I forget that myself, and I'm outside working, and then I'm dizzy, you know, about to pass out. And so helping people to know that they got to stay hydrated in this type of weather, that they got to be more concerned about the elderly, that they got to look at how that impacts young people with asthma and breathing conditions. And so I think that once you talk to people about things that they haven't thought about before, that that's the beginning of the process. One of the things that we did last...
Why is it important to talk about heat and staying safe in these events and, like, community-oriented events like this? You know, like, why use this opportunity to teach people? What is it about bringing people together? Well, maybe it's super obvious to
you,
but...
For us, we don't do things to the community. We do it with the community. So the first thing today, what we're going to be asking people is, do they want to be involved in this project? Do they want to help design it? Do they want to be the decision makers in it? Because we really lean toward their expertise. They know what they're dealing with, and most of the time they know how to fix it. And so when we come out into the community, it's because we need them. We can't do it without them. and we're definitely not going to do it to them. So that's why we out here today. And the environment creates that that mood, that vibe. You know, we like our oldies, and so that's what we out here doing today. And we like food. Yeah. People come together around food, and so we're going to be out here barbecuing, we're going to be listening to this good music, and we're going to be talking to people and signing them up to be a part of the climate justice team that we're going to build out.
So that's the
Danelle points down the street to the sprawl of pavement, to the shuttered master lock factory, to the affordable housing apartments where residents were evacuated last year because of lingering industrial contamination. She wants to empower her community to advocate for themselves and come up with the solutions they want to see in their own neighborhood. Later, Danelle introduces me to Bianca Dotz. She says I should talk to her to get a sense for what community care looks like.
I grew up in the neighborhood, been here since I was one. We moved over here. My grandmother still lives here. She refuses to leave because she loves the neighborhood, so she's still here. But of course, she's older and she has breathing problems. She's on oxygen now. And they have.
Bianca lives in Arizona, where she's going to nursing school. But she comes back when she can to see her grandmother. Last summer, when smoke from Canadian wildfires filled the sky, Metcalf Park Community Bridges went into action. They used rapid response funding to buy 100 air purifiers. They gave them away to elderly neighbors, people with asthma. Bianca's grandmother got one, and they taught her how to set it up.
Yeah. I mean, do you worry about heat in the neighborhood with your grandmother? Like, how do you think about that?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like a lot of the houses around here are not as up to date with central air and everything as they could be or probably even should be. And so there's that issue. And I'm sorry, the kids are just hilarious. So there's always that issue. And like I said, she's on oxygen, and it's something that before she didn't need it, but as time goes on, it's pollution, it's, you know, a lot of house fires have happened that also pollutes the air, and she's breathing that in, but she's also like stern on this is her neighborhood and this is where she wants to stay and keep her independence and everything going. So I'm going to support her however I can, and I'm glad that they've been providing the purifiers and helping her with cleaning it out, changing it. Anything she needs, they go by and they check on her for me. And
that's an amazing resource.
The community gives Bianca peace of mind. She knows her grandmother's taken care of, even when she's far away.
Because no matter what, there's still love here. There's still, it's a community. I mean, it might not be as big as everybody else's community, but it's a community, and she knows that there are people here who look out for her and have her back if she needs it. And I can't deny that for her. She can have it. And especially me being so far, I'm comfortable with, you know, okay, go ahead. We can let you just stay here. I'm not gonna fight you on that. You have all the support. She can go on her porch, call neighbors down and talk to them. They plant flowers. They have the flower event. She always gets something. And if she doesn't get a flower, then she's calling me, hey, you know, where's everybody at? They were supposed to bring me some flowers this year. Nobody brought me any flowers. So
Grandma deserves her flowers.
She does. And she loves to watch them grow. So. Yeah.
Looking around the barbecue, I see what Bianca's grandmother loves about her neighborhood. Some kids splash in kiddie pools filled with melting ice. Antoine's working the grill, and organizers pass out cold water. People are taking care of each other. For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran reporting from Metcalf Park. You also heard from Antoine Carter, Bianca Dotz, and the leaders of Metcalf Park Community Bridges, Danelle Cross and Melody McCurtis. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll tell you about the documentary No One Asked You, which follows a years-long fight for abortion rights. But first, we'll tell you about a musical and visual performance called The Moth Project. Stay tuned to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Don't forget you're young on a hot summer night. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A New York City-based musician will be performing in Madison next week. It's a show Peter Kiesewalter didn't expect to create, called The Moth Project. Inspiration struck Kiesewalter during the COVID-19 pandemic, when he was isolated and had more time to slow down and observe nature. He joins WUWM's Susan Bentz to talk about the show.
So here in New York City, it really felt like we were ground zero for what was happening. And we were all quite terrified. So in the summer, as soon as my three kids were done school, and they were just doing it online with Whitney, my partner, and we headed for the family cottage in Canada. We quarantined first for 2 weeks before my little brother and his three kids joined us for the rest of the summer. All my work had been canceled. I'm a musician. So I was looking at a year worth of work as a music director with a particular singer I was about to go on tour with. That was all gone. Whitney's work, she mostly plays on Broadway and as a freelance violinist, all that's gone. And we're just sitting there thinking, well, how are we going to pay the rent? And over campfire, slowly, my little brother, who is a interpretive naturalist, park ranger, I was watching these moths. I've been going to this family cottage for 45 years, by the way, and I'd never paid attention. Never. He's already a birder, but he took up mothing as a hobby. And when I saw the pictures that he was taking, my mind was blown. I had not paid attention for 45 years at the sheer diversity and number of species that I couldn't believe it. I thought there were two, and there's 160,000, 2,000 or 3,000 of which are sort of focused in that part of the country. So around campfires, I was watching these moths go to the flame, which is all we know about them, right? Moth, like a moth to flame. It's a bad metaphor for Fatal Attraction. So many pop songs, right? Like there's a million songs. There's a scientific theory about that called transverse orientation, where they use the light to navigate at nighttime. But even then, science is not completely in agreement about that. So I started to do a little bit of homework. Why is it that Western mythologies associate moths with death and destruction? And the indigenous modalities, some of which I started to see online, were like, moths are guardians of dreamtime. They are the bridge between life and death. They are symbols of transformation, metamorphosis, of hope.
So did moths become an inspiration, an obsession, or a little of both?
For me, it was about, well, I think there's something here that resonates with me as a freelance musician. For one, these moths self-immolating in the fire, I thought, I think I'm kind of a lot like these critters. I'm nocturnal. I come out at nighttime. I'm highly adaptive as a musician. I've made a living playing music for 40 years, so I have to adapt. But also, this drawn to the flame thing, even though we know it's not good for us eventually, I felt resonance in moths, and I thought it'd be interesting to see if I could put together an hour, 75-minute show based around these creatures. What I started to do was have a parallel narrative arc about my family through the filter of a life cycle of a moth. The show is more about my parents than it is about moths, actually. When people are surprised when they see it. There's a lot of moth imagery, a lot of moth science, a lot of moth mythology, but really I'm talking about myself and other immigrants. You know, in the case of my parents coming from Europe, especially from Germany, it's like, lay low, don't stick out, don't tell people you're German. They had to sort of ease their way into North American society on the lowdown, which a lot of immigrants have to do, right? Same with moths and caterpillars. They spend the majority of their life cycle hiding so that the birds don't eat them. They're just until they build a cocoon and come out these fabulous, winged, gorgeous, beautiful creatures and say, look at me, here I am. But up until then, it's like they're working hard and trying to blend in.
I want to dip into the music. Do you want to start with those opening measures, or do you suggest cut further into the piece?
Good question. I mean, the opening thing, a lot of people don't catch a lot of the musical references. The opening thing is Aaron Copland's Fanfare for a Common Man. What I'm saying right off the bat is, listen, I'm just a normal, common person. And up until now, I just thought this is how I was supposed to live my life. Just sort of eyes on the road, hands on the wheel. But I felt like I was kind of waking up that summer, like stop, slow down, take stock. And for me, I literally woke up to the surroundings at the cottage. And I'm lucky, I'm a privileged person that I have a family compound like that, that we can do that at. But I literally was seeing things and hearing things that I had not for my entire life. So that opening number, even though people might not know it's from Aaron Copland or that it's Fanfare for a Common Man, for me sets the tone that I'm just a regular person and I feel like I'm waking up right now. So it's as good as any piece to begin with, I think.
Describe what the audience sees and experiences when they walk into the theater.
They
You
see,
and your partner on the
that's it.
stage.
Myself and Whitney come in, they see a huge video screen. We wear white and we literally disappear into the projections. And there's projections on us for about 70 minutes. There's 12 songs, which are quite eclectic. That's also by design to reflect the diversity of the moth species themselves, or the natural world. In between songs, there's interstitial narrative stories, mostly dealing with what my family went through. The song then will pick up on that thread and sort of compare it to the natural world, what moths or what other living creatures go through that are very much the same as what any human being goes through, particularly those who come or leave their country and go somewhere else, right, to migrate. So that's what the audience sees and hears with a very integrated visual display. There's always something happening. It's very tied to the music and the dialogue is very tied to what's happening in behind us and on top of us.
I'd love to dip into In My Dream, which again is very personal. Talk about that if you would.
Well, but before I get into that tune, out of the 12 tunes we do, half are covers, half I've written for the show. This is a particular tune. It's by a close friend of mine, a Canadian singer-songwriter named Jane Sibbery. I produced a record for her a couple of years ago. It did not make it on the record. She said, "I love this song. Do whatever you want with it." And given that I was starting to learn some indigenous modalities, considered moths the guardians of Dreamtime. If a moth visits you in your dream, pay attention. Or if a moth might guide you to the dream you're supposed to be having. I'm one of those, I don't remember my dreams, but in 1990, when my older brother Tom passed away, from that day on for 2 years, I had the same dream every single night. We were walking his dog every night in my dream for 2 years, you know? It was like, well, there he is again. And Jane's tune that did not make it on the record was literally about her family in her dream. So I thought it was an appropriate tune for the show. Because the show has a little bit of personal stuff about my family, my siblings, a lot about my parents. Given the whole connection that moths as a species have with dreams, I felt it was an appropriate and fitting tune for the record and for the show.
You've been performing this across the country and well in Canada and the US since about a year ago, right? So is there an experience on stage after being on stage, talking with people in whichever community that is sticking with you most?
Well, the first one we did, we were invited through my younger brother. He goes to a conference every year of North American interpretive naturalists. There's 1,200 that come every year. It's in a different city. In 2022, it was in Cleveland. They invited us to come do their keynote presentation in front of, 1,000 interpretive naturalists in a ballroom to kick off their 4-day conference. A number of them came up to us in tears afterwards and said, "This is exactly what we've been looking for. Like, this is what we need. Scientists, we need to get together with you guys, with artists, because no one's listening to us. People have been ignoring us for 50 years, and the earth has been screaming this at the top of its lungs for forever. And no one pays attention. We need you guys to help get the message across." May have been a half a dozen of them came up to us afterwards, and they were literally in tears saying, "This is the most amazing thing we've ever seen." And then and there, I knew, I think I was onto something. Music is my way. Music and story and these pictures are a way that I'm connecting and sharing my connection to the natural world with people. So that first show in front of 1,000 scientists was quite heavy, quite memorable, quite moving. There have been others, but that was a big one for sure.
Peter Kiesewalter is a composer, music director, and producer. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. The Moth Project is coming to the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison next week. You can find more information at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and when we return, we'll tell you about a documentary that approaches abortion access with a sense of humor. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM.
You on this journey with me now. Welcome to my—
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A documentary called No One Asked You follows comedian Liz Winstead and her abortion access front made up of activists, writers, producers, and fellow comedians who use humor to destigmatize abortion and fight against anti-abortion groups nationwide. The documentary follows the group's seven-year journey, including a stop here in Milwaukee, that puts abortion providers and clinic volunteers in the spotlight. No One Asked You is directed by Ruth Lightman and co-produced by Susan Kearns. It's showing at Milwaukee's Oriental Theater on Monday. Lightman and Kearns join me to share more about the film. How did you come to know of the Abortion Access Front and the Vagical Mystery Tour spearheaded by comedian Liz Winstead?
I met Liz in 2012 at Netroots Nation, which is this amazing conference, best of grassroots organizing on the net. And Liz was there with her book, Liz Free or Die, which had a really beautiful essay in it about her abortion story, which really resonated with me. And then, you know, cut to 4 years later, it's the day after the 2016 election, and I'm watching MSNBC as I would often, and there would be Liz talking about what is happening in abortion access, except now things are about to get much worse. And so, you know, as all of us were, you know, sad, crying, trying to figure out what we were going to do, I thought, wow, this is about to be really awful. And I need a little levity. I need a little, you know, comedy in my life. And we were really fortunate that we reached out to them and they were willing to let us follow them with a camera for what turned out to be 7 years. And, you know, this sort of flashpoint was that they were about to go on the Vagical Mystery Tour, a 16-city USO meets Habitat for Humanity tour across the Midwest and Southern battleground states.
Susan, can you share how you became involved in this film, some of your roles over the course of filming, and go into a bit of detail about what the Vagical Mystery Tour involved in visiting clinics around the country?
Yeah, so I will talk about my involvement, and then I'll pass it back to Ruth for the Vagical Mystery Tour part. I actually became involved later with the Garbage Fire Festival that was in Milwaukee. So Ruth, she knows that I live in Milwaukee up here. So she was like, hey, this is happening. We need a bunch of filmmakers, and we need to cover different parts of the city at the same time. You know, can you help? And it was really kind of an amazing moment, I felt like, for Milwaukee to kind of rally behind this film, because we literally had teams of filmmakers in different parts of the city covering things like not just the comedy shows, but also the protests that were happening. And it was really exciting to see filmmakers come out to want to support Ruth, want to support Abortion Access Front, and really want to make sure that people in the city knew what was happening to help support our ability to protect abortion access in Wisconsin.
And Susan helped to facilitate literally crews all over the entire city because there was so much going on. But the reason for the Garbage Fire Festival in the first place was it was a counter protest to what was happening in the city. Every year, anti-abortion extremists find a city in an abortion vulnerable state and descend upon that city and state for a week to 10 days. And in 2019, they picked Milwaukee and also Madison.
The whole concept of humor as a radical act, can you talk about that a little bit and how that's a focal point to this film?
Sure. I mean, I think that in the pro-abortion movement, there are so many different organizations, people who provide support in different ways. And one of the reasons why we decided to follow Liz and Abortion Access Fund is centering comedy and using comedy and outrage as a way to bring people together and bring empathy and love and joy to something that's really hard every day. And so what you see in the film is Abortion Access Front going to one of these 16 cities and beyond and getting to know the people at the clinic, getting to know the providers, and getting to know the clinic escorts, listening to them about what they need. Do they need some new steps because somebody tried to trash their stairs? Do they need water because they're in the middle of Mississippi and they need cartons of water to bring to the escorts? And then Liz used her celebrity to bring together some of the best up-and-coming comics from across the country and bring them to these towns to have a comedy show, bring people together, build a larger community so that when the comics left, they had a good time and these people could volunteer and be involved. And then, of course, there was a talk back afterwards so that people would understand what was happening locally in their community.
This film also centers the providers. Yes, it's about this troop of comedians and other volunteers visiting clinics, but it really ask them, what do you need? What is your concern? What can we help with, no matter how big or small? And I'm curious about, with your experiences in these different cities or here in Milwaukee, what are the commonalities that you found in the people who staff and volunteer at abortion clinics across the U.S.?
I'll tell you one thing that's really beautiful about the escorts from Affiliated Medical Services. So after Roe was overturned and they had to close, and everyone had to close in Wisconsin, you know, they were really working hard to be able to come back. And when the clinic reopened, those same escorts came back, which is, you know, incredible. You know, one of them went off to grad school to come back. You know, they went off and did what they needed to do with their lives, but they came back because it's a calling. I think the commonality with all of them is that they're going to integrate their life plans, their work plans, around being a clinic escort. So you have Dorinda in Mississippi who planned her work and really reduced her work so that she could be a full-time volunteer and a part-time restaurant worker. And I think that that's a commonality with all of them, is that as hard and as brutal as this work is, they're not going to abandon it anytime soon because they know that their work is critical to turning the tide.
With this film and the whole process, especially for you, Ruth, over 7 years, about in the last section, it's that speed up to current day. How do you hope audiences will respond or feel after watching No One Asked You?
Well, it was really important that once Roe was overturned with Dobbs in Mississippi, that we not only add more comedy, but we gave people the idea that they could all be engaged in the solution. And so it was really great that Liz and her team came up with this day, Operation Save Abortion, where they had 10,000 people streaming for 8 hours in one day, giving people instruction and activities and little bits of information, showing them that each person can do something. Because I think that what we had was a country full of people who were surprised, and we had so much activism fatigue after all that we had been through, you know, in the 6 years before that. Sort of, how do you bring together people to then engage and be able to go out and do something about it. And so what we want people to walk away from the film is that they can be a part of the solution, and they need to be.
Ruth Lightman is the director of the documentary No One Asked You, and Milwaukee filmmaker Susan Kearns is one of the co-producers. We spoke earlier this year, and you can see the film again on Monday at the Oriental Theater as an encore Best of Fest presentation. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Emily Files, Lena Tran, Eddie Morales, Taryn Powell, Mayan Silver, and Susan Bentz from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valero Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a look at this year's report card for Wisconsin's infrastructure. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.